Welcome. Hola. Bienvenidos. Bonjour et bienvenue to the Social Network Show. Welcome to the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media. We give you actionable information to make your social networking the best it can be for business to business, business to consumer, and for folks who just like to post. And now, broadcasting from the studios of the Hank Greenspoon School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, the host of the Social Network Show, Jim Nico, and Dr. Jane Karwoski.
Welcome to the Social Network Show, where Jim Nico and I, Jane Karwoski, will be discussing some important things with Dr. Robert McChesney from the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, and about what is happening with democracy under its onslaught of capitalism, which is a little more political, perhaps, than we usually get, but it's very fascinating because media is intimately involved in this. So if you'll be hearing him talk about this topic in relationship to his new book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century.
I love the title. It's great.
Yeah. Well, Dr. McChesney is an American professor at the University of Illinois and in the Department of Communication. His work concentrates on the history and political economy of communication, emphasizing the role media play in democratic and capitalistic societies. So, welcome to the Social Network Show. Now, in your book, I want to focus on your new book because it is the latest in your numerous attempts to clarify issues for the public, and I think you do such a wonderful job of it. And it's a wonderful history, too, I think, in that it definitely sets the stage and helps us understand how did we get to this place in situation with media, government, and big business. Can you tell us about what you mean by blowing the roof off the 21st century and why it's necessary?
I'd be glad to give it a start. You know, what I argue in this book and what I've really been working on in my research has been the tension and the problems that are inherent between a capitalist economy and democratic self-government. And these are tensions that have been well known since the beginning of capitalism, that have been documented even by capitalism's strongest proponents. They understood there were problems with the way it worked for a democratic or humane society. And I think those problems have grown in recent years. I think the benefits that capitalism provides a society, and the benefits are many. They include, you know, vast expansion in the amount of goods and services, the quality of life, the standard of living, absolutely central to capitalism. But those benefits have trickled in recent years, and the price, the cost of capitalism, especially for democratic governance and for our liberties, has diminished. The price has been high, I should say. The cost of capitalism has been high. And I think we're seeing worldwide, not just in the United States, that the tension is exploding. And it's exploding to the point where we really have to make a choice. We're either going to bow down to the owners of society, the wealthy, and satisfy their needs first and foremost, or we're going to say we have to do something with our economy so we can have a successful democratic society with the liberties, freedoms, and democratic control over policymaking that is foundational to a free society.
Well, you make one point early on in the book that really existing capitalism, as you put it, consists of massive corporations, commercial propaganda, political corruption, obscene inequality, poverty, stagnation, militarism, and endless greed. And that when organized wealth wants one thing and the mass of people want another, money wins always. So what I know that to answer the question, how did we get here, would take several books, which you fortunately have already written. But how does media play into this? And what I'm really wanting to get at eventually is, does the internet and the ability of individuals to broadcast their views and discuss things, does that help the situation? And where does media reform actually stand at this point?
Well, media are right in the middle of all this, Dr. J. Going back to the beginning of our republic and the founding debates over the Constitution, it was well understood by the framers of the Constitution that you had to have a credible press system, a free press, that had to really draw people into public life if you were going to have genuine democracy. If you're going to have democracy, which it means in the classical sense, which Jefferson and Madison understood, it means that people without property have the same control over society as people with property. That's what distinguished democracy from earlier forms of governance. I mean, the nobility had their version of democracy in the Middle Ages. It just didn't include the bottom 95% of the population. Democracy meant you extended it to everyone, even if they didn't own property. And the news media, the media were the crucial institution, along with education, that made that theory an actual possibility. So you have to have a credible news media so people know what's going on in the world, have access to informed and competing opinions and detailed research and investigation that's made accessible to the average person, or else democracy is in form only. It becomes a joke. And much of my research has been about the process that our news media have really been taken over and colonized by dominant interests so that, you know, we have much less news today than we had a generation ago, and we have news that tends to basically parrot what people in power are debating. So if they're debating an issue, it gets covered. If they're not debating an issue, it isn't. But it doesn't really serve the needs of those of people outside of power to monitor people in power and to change course if they're dissatisfied with the status quo.
No, certainly not. And it also makes it very focused on America, because so much of the time the news, the mainstream news that most people watch, is just entirely focused on the United States. It's rare that you know, if you want to know what's going on in the rest of the world, well, you'll know what damage the weather has done in the United States. So...
Your point is so well taken, Jane, because, you know, the United States spends $1 trillion a year all total on militarism and security and spying. I mean, you add all the expenses together, nuclear weapons, more than the rest of the world combined, or at least the same amount of all the other countries in the world combined. We have hundreds of military bases in scores of countries around the world. No other country has bases outside its own borders, I think, in the whole world.
Really?
We dominate the world. We're now at so many wars with so many countries that people can't keep score anymore. We know when you hear about drone attacks in this country or that country every other day. Yet we have a population that basically is almost entirely ignorant of what's going on in the world. This is precisely the conflict the framers of our Constitution meant to avoid. They did not want to let people in power be able to engage in sort of worldwide war without the people in the country being able to know about it and stop it if they didn't want it. And that's the situation we're now in. Your example you gave is perfect. There was the election in Greece last weekend. Now it's 8 days ago, in which Greece elected an anti-austerity party to really challenge the depression that Greece has been in now for 6 years. And this is a major news story. This is one of the most important elections, arguably, in the last 25 years in the world. And if you went to U.S. news media, our cable TV channels, where informed people are supposed to go to learn about the world, you know, it was barely covered. Purported snowstorm that never really quite hit New York City was the subject of endless speculation and gibberish. Yet the most important political election will have great ramifications for all other nations in the world, virtually uncovered. Most Americans wouldn't even know it took place.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. That's true.
I'm one of them. I never heard about it. Interesting.
Well, another case is a big event in Spain a few years ago regarding a popular uprising, you might say. I'm sure you know what I mean, even though that's about all I remember about it, but I read about it in one of Manuel Castells' books.
Well, I'll even tell you this, it wasn't just a few years ago, but just in the past week, there were literally enormous demonstrations in Spain against austerity, because Spain, like Greece, has been in a five-year depression. We're talking about 20% unemployment for people under 25 or 30, 40, 50, 60% unemployment. And the economies are dead. And that's where the tension I talk about between capitalism and democracy is right at the forefront. If you're going to have genuine democracy, you've got to somehow come up with an economy that can provide sustenance to the people who live in the country.
Right.
Otherwise, it just doesn't work.
So I have a quick question here. So first of all, this is always on my mind. Is there somewhere where we can get access to enough news and enough objective reporting of news? That's the first part. And then the second part is, do you see like a company like ours who's devoted to women's empowerment and trying to catalyze fairness and justice on social networks, do you see that the niche media companies rising is a way to go? I mean, do you think that we're in the right spot on this?
Sure. You know, I think the unfortunately for most Americans today, the problem they face is that, you know, unless you're not working and you're, you know, independently wealthy, it takes an inordinate amount of time to comb the internet, to read publications, to really get a sense of what's going on in the world. And then the added to that, in the United States and most places worldwide, we've seen a sharp drop in the number of paid reporters in the past 25 years. You know, in city after city, we're maybe one-third of the number of paid working reporters in any media as there was 25 years ago. So because of that, a lot of stories aren't being covered anymore that used to be covered. In state capitals around the country, in Wisconsin and Illinois, states I know well, where at one time there were 25 or 30 full-time reporters, now there might just be two, three, or four.
Can I, another way I might just rephrase the one question is, so without being personal or anything, how did you know about a story that wasn't being covered? I mean, is there a source that you can, I'm not saying ask to endorse, but that you got it from, or is it something you can't share?
No, well, I have a series of websites I go to. The Guardian newspaper and website is very good. There's a number of others. Unfortunately for me, I'm in a situation where a number of people email me stories all the time. I have a number of friends who do that for this, their hobby. So they send me stuff and
they get
on top of issues.
Makes sense.
But, you know, going to your point about your show and what you're doing, you know, I think we need a lot of different approaches to solve the problem. But ultimately, the crucial thing we need are well-funded, independent, competing institutions that are responsible for generating news and held accountable for it and are judged by it. And what we lack that today. That's a public policy issue that the framers of this country addressed directly. We have to address it again directly because the commercial system is dead.
Well, and one of the things, thank you, that was a brilliant answer. And one of the things that Dr. Jay and I realized years ago when we started the show is we could never scoop the news or be the first to report it. But we figured if we could provide very smart commentary and bring on the people that could really comment and analyze the news and the ramifications of it, that would play a very pivotal role. And that's what we've been doing. So I hope it's working. And bringing you on is one of the milestones for us because it gives us perspective, which a lot of times we just can't seem to get.
Well, I think there's a terrific role for shows like this. The only point I would add to that, the sobering point, is I remember an interview with Jay Leno, the TV comedian who hosted the Tonight Show for 20-some years. And Jay Leno said that over the course of his 20 years, what he learned was, you can no longer assume that people watching the show knew anything about the news or had any idea what was going on in the world. So when he wanted to do political jokes, he always had to set them up by the end of his career, explaining what the joke was about, who Mitch McConnell was, who Harry Reid was, what a trade deal was, what income taxes were. You could just assume everyone got it. And I think that's part of the problem a show like this will always face is, you know, if there's a really high degree of understanding and debate in society, then you can layer on top of that, and really it's exciting. But if you've got to start at the elementary level just to get people up to speed, it limits what you're able to do with a program like this.
Well, let's talk about that in the second half of our show today. And you're listening to Bob McChesney from the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana. And I am Jane Karwoski along with Jim Nico on the Social Network Show.
Questions? Comments? Email us at questions@thesocialnetworkshow.com. We'll be right back.
As internet technology advances, so does the threat of cybercrime. And the instant you go online, you become vulnerable to dangers such as identity theft, computer viruses, phishing, spyware, and more. In times like these, we must all protect ourselves from cybercrime. Antivirus software, firewalls, and security patches are just the beginning. Never open suspicious emails, only navigate to trusted sites, and change your passwords every 90 days. Backup important files to external storage devices. Tell anyone who uses your computer to be vigilant when downloading from the internet. Keep your kids safe on the internet. Teach them never to give out personal information or post information about their school or extracurricular activities. Installing parental control software and monitoring their computer are all good ways to prevent cybercrime. To learn more about cybercrime, visit ncpc.org or contact your local law enforcement agency.
A message from the U.S. Department of Justice, National Crime Prevention Council, and the Ad Council.
Now, back to the Social Network Show.
Welcome back to the Social Network Show, where Jim Nico and I are talking with Bob McChesney, Professor of Communications at University of Illinois. So you have been telling us about the lack of awareness, you might say, of the crucial issues facing our society today. And it's not just in the United States. These things have worldwide ramifications because, as you pointed out, the United States has infiltrated
interests
all around the world, and will spin the news in a particular way and so forth. So you mentioned that political humorists have a harder time these days because a lot of people don't realize what the situation is that they're making fun of. And it reminded me of in Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, the book we're talking about, is that Ralph Nader in 2000, when he was running for president, Michael Moore introduced him, and his then with much humor and really warmed up the audience, you might say, but Nader pointed out that it's a sad commentary that the only amount of politics that people really tune into anymore is humor. There's very little serious discussion about the serious topics. So say there's micro commentaries, you might say, through blogs or podcasts, etc. What else is needed? Obviously that, or maybe it isn't so obvious, but your research has shown that that's not enough to actually make any kind of changes, policy changes, etc. But how does the average person kind of get any traction on affecting any kind of change there? You say that there's a lot going on, but we just don't hear about it. So could you tell us about that?
Well, there's a lot there. Great question. You know, one of the things that my research, I think, has tried to demonstrate, especially the work I've done with my friend John Nichols, is that we travel around the country a lot, and what we see is that there are a lot of people who really care about this country, who are working hard to do stuff, and no one really knows about it because we don't have much journalism anymore. So there's this tremendous movement across the United States, for example, to pass a constitutional amendment to take the money out of politics. Now, when we talk about this in our talks, or I go around and do interviews like this, people in the audience will say, I had no idea. That must be hopeless. There must not be any chance that could work. I haven't heard anything about this. And compared to the amount of attention the Equal Rights Amendment got during the period in which people were trying to get that added to the U.S. Constitution, which got immense amounts of publicity. It was well known across the country. Mm-hmm. This has gotten almost no attention whatsoever. And in fact, we've already gotten, I think, 15 or 16 states have already approved it. It's popular across the political spectrum, but it's just no one knows about it. And it's an anomaly of our time, or paradox. There is actually quite a bit of political activism, but since no one knows about it, a lot of people get demobilized, they give up hope, and say, well, gee, no one's doing anything, so why should I do anything? And it's become a real problem for us.
Well, yeah, and you mentioned the feeling of helplessness and hopelessness that you encounter on your book tours and so forth, that ended up being the main topic you needed to address. And I encounter it myself with people that I talk with. But we're in kind of a catch-22 situation because the media, being in league, you might say, or controlled by the big money interests, the huge corporations that are also lobbying Congress, to where it is money running the government. And so I can see why money in politics is such a huge issue. But what, again, that really comes back to Jim's question. Some international newspapers is one thing you mentioned, which are online, of course. Any other ideas as far as like tuning into that type of reform movement and finding them?
Well, I think for solving the media problem, you know, I've written about this, that like there are real policies that could set up well-funded, independent, uncensored nonprofit news media, non-commercial news media. It's a solvable problem. The question is whether there can be the political momentum to make it happen. Our news media in the first 100 years of American history, we had a wonderful press system, very competitive, and it was largely subsidized by the federal government through postal subsidies, which paid for the distribution of all the newspapers in the country. And you know, we can have that sort of policy again. But I would say we need, though, and clearly the evidence is in, I think, on this one, to get such a policy considered, to get something enacted that would give us that sort of news media is going to not only just create a movement later of involved citizens, but it's going to require a movement of involved citizens. I guess that's the catch-22 to come about. I think that people listening to this show have simply got to get active. They've got to get serious. And it's not really an option. I think that's the point people understand. At some point, what's happening now is unacceptable to our democracy, to our culture, to our society, and it requires participation. And you're going to have to do it sooner or later. So the sooner you do it, the more likely we'll get results that will be equitable and fair.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at some of the movements that have occurred in recent years, and I think of the Occupy movement. Can you say, I mean, a lot of that was against the huge amount of money in very few people's hands and so forth, the monopoly capitalism and so forth. What's the result? Were they able to make any headway? Is it still going on, or really, did anything happen?
Well, you know, I think the Occupy movement was entirely unexpected. No one saw it coming. It caught everyone. I mean, literally, I think everyone in the country, including the people who launched it, by surprise. And I think, you know, what was astonishing to people was that there was so much sympathy for the Occupy activists. And it was, everyone got it. Everyone understood that inequality and poverty in this country are obscene, especially in the richest country ever in the history of the human race. Simply an outrage that we have this situation. And no one could critique or criticize people protesting that this was an unacceptable situation. So I think that was the most important thing about Occupy was that it just existed. It didn't have a coherent plan for an agenda, didn't have sort of a party running it. It was just simply masses of Americans saying, enough of this. This has got to stop. And accordingly, it didn't really get anywhere. But to dismiss it as a one-off and say, well, that was funny. That's weird how that happened. Don't expect to see that again. It's sort of silly. The pressures that led to Occupy have grown more severe. They're growing more severe. They're not going away. I think we'll eventually, historically, look at Occupy as sort of the foothills, and the mountains are up ahead. And the mountains might be up ahead in a few years or might be a decade or two. But the problems that led to Occupy aren't going away. They're only getting worse. And eventually people will act. And I think our job as scholars, as reporters, as citizens, is to understand the situation so we can have democratic and humane solutions to these problems rather than be thrown into a crisis and end up with a solution that would be very undesirable, which would happen if people aren't involved in making decisions.
And you mentioned a lot about the influence of the huge corporations in something called the Business Roundtable, and that no legislation has been passed in decades without their approval. And that contains what kind of corporations are involved in the Business Roundtable?
This is the elite of the elite. The Business Roundtable is a sort of a corporate club of just a few dozen of the premier corporations, the largest in the country. This job basically is to advise politicians and tell them what they want. And they tend to get what they want. They tend to get their way. In fact, I would say they always get their way. Mm-hmm. They tend to be successful. In this book, as in my other books, I spend some time chronicling how this took place. A lot of people say, well, that's the way it is in America. The bad guys always win. Money always rules. Democracy never gets a fair shake. But in fact, that's not true. In American history, we have wonderful moments throughout much of the 20th century, in fact, in which all sorts of popular democratic reforms were instituted, not because people with money wanted them, but because people without money organized, did the hard political work, and democratically got things like Social Security, democratically got Medicare, democratically got the Voting Rights Act, democratically got the Environmental Protection Agency. Those were all great victories. And what we face today is that since that wave of victories in the 20th century, the Business Roundtable, the corporate community, the Chamber of Commerce, by the 1970s said, enough of this. We've got to get the government back to how it used to be in the good old days of the 1880s and 1890s when we just lost our teeth with politicians' underpants. And, you know, so they've done everything in their power to minimize the ability of ordinary people to actively engage with and influence government policy. That's what's got to be stopped, and that's what's got to be changed.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned those successes, because it is easy to get that negative feeling of, you know, hopeless and helpless. So those are good things to hearken back to and see that. And I like your point that journalism is crucial to it, because how else is the public going to be informed of the hope of the possibility of change and a creation of an independent, uncensored, nonprofit, non-commercial news media that is government funded but not government controlled? So that is something that is in complete harmony with democracy and actually required for it. So we'll look forward to, I really recommend Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, the book by Robert W. McChesney, Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy. Thank you so much for joining us, Bob. Really appreciated your input.
My great pleasure, and good luck with the show.
Thank you. And thanks also to you, our listeners, and most important guests, for keeping us company on The Social Network Show. Do visit our website at thesocialnetworkstation.com. You'll also find us on iTunes and podcast1.com, and can follow us on Twitter at socialnetshow. And until we meet you here again, please have fun and be safe online and off.
You've been listening to The Social Network Show, the only worldwide show dedicated to social networking and social media, coming to you from the studios of the Hank Greenspan School of Journalism and Media Studies of UNLV, the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Listen to archived shows and follow us on Twitter. The views expressed on the Social Network Show are those of the hosts and guests and may not be the views of Social Network Intermedia. The Social Network Show is produced by Social Network Intermedia, copyright 2012.